You're on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I mean to plant a flag in the sand for conscious, willful people to gather, organize, empathize, and capsize the established order of things. Our opposition? Team Machine, Team Capitalism, Team Algorithm, Team No Team, I'm my own team. Being human is a team sport, so thanks for playing. Playing for Team Human today, media activist and scholar Geert Lovink.
We thinkers, artists, activists, cultural workers, we have a special responsibility because we are working in the concept factories. We can make a difference.
Geert will be helping us see how an understanding of the political economy is not enough. We have to reacquaint ourselves with the experiential layer of our humanity and even reclaim our sadness to counter the stultifying effects of platform capitalism. My new book, Team Human, a manifesto drawn from the experience and learnings of this show, is just off the presses and ready for pre-order. Yes, that's a hint. Order the book, the ebook, or even the audiobook now if you can, or tell your library to get it. I feel like I should be embarrassed asking you to buy my book, but it's not like I'm asking you to buy it so I can get rich. Really, since the beginning, I've seen my books less as a business than as propaganda, really more like the theater I used to do. It's pollen-spreading ideas. The books are really meant as totems, almost sigil magic. The more Team Human books out there, the more humans will be aware of the team. And I do spend the money I make on it, or a significant portion of it, just buying books for students and people on free Team Human live events and on this show. I'm going to spend as much of the coming months traveling as I can, given the limitations of family and all the real-life challenges that many of them are facing right now. I'll get the whole tour listed on rushkoff.com. It's New York, D.C., L.A., San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, Austin, Texas, Toronto. But if you want me to get to someplace in particular, be sure to get in touch. Just email team@teamhuman.fm and let us know where you want us. We're going to be taking a week or two off for the holidays, but we'll be replaying some favorite episodes and special content over the break. Then I'll be doing shows throughout the tour, beginning with a Team Human Live tomorrow evening, Thursday, December 12th, at the Civic Hall in New York City, with Mark Pesci and Penny Abewardina. I'll be doing interviews with people everywhere I go, monologues from hotel rooms, and some recordings of the more interesting events. So January through March should make for some really interesting content from around the U.S. and London. People have been asking me what this book is about, you know, and I keep telling them, well, it's a manifesto for Team Human and all that, but there is something specific. I mean, there is a newsworthy story in there, and that is that there is a Silicon Valley religion embedded in the technologies that we're using, in Google and Uber and Facebook and Amazon, among others. It's a techno-utopian and deeply anti-human sensibility. And it was really first hatched when the self-help movement of the Bay Area was married to a futurist Russian philosophy called cosmism. And the idea was that technology would be our evolutionary successor, that humans are essentially computational, and that computers could do this better than humans. And these values were really taught at Stanford, in the philosophy classes of René Girard to some extent, and certainly the captology classes of B.J. Fogg. And as a result, we have the graduates of those programs at Facebook using algorithms to program people's behaviors. We have graduates at Uber using machine learning to replace people's employment. We have Google developing artificial intelligences to replace human consciousness. We have Amazon extracting the life's blood of the human marketplace to deliver returns to the abstracted economy of stock derivatives. The anti-human agenda of technologists maybe wouldn't be so bad if it didn't dovetail so neatly with the anti-human agenda of corporate capitalism. Each one enables the other, reinforcing an abstract, growth-based scheme of infinite expansion. And it's utterly compatible with human life or sustainability of our ecosystem. We're not being beaten by machines, but by a league of tech billionaires who've been taught that human beings are the problem and technology is the solution. We have to become aware of their agenda and fight it if we're going to survive.
I'm Ramesh Srinivasan, and I'm on Team Human.
I'm Molly Wright Steenson, and I'm on Team Human.
My name is Damian Williams, and I'm on Team Human.
I'm Jamie Cohen, and I'm on Team Human.
We're Team Human, coming to you alive from the Basement Media Squad, home to the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at CUNY Queens College. You can support Team Human by subscribing to our show. Just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support. You can also read my columns based on the show's monologues at medium.com/@Rushkoff. And how do we fight the machine? Well, today's show takes me back to the origins of what became known as tactical media, using interactive media from camcorders and billboards to the internet to promote the human agenda. I really first learned of it from today's guest, media theorist and intellectual hacker Geert Lovink. He's best known, I think, as the editor of Mediamatic, a magazine of the early and late 90s. He was the editor of the Money Lab Readers, which are these anthologies of alternative economic strategies. And right now he's founding director of the Institute of Network Cultures. And his new book is coming out actually in a couple of months, Sad by Design on Platform Nihilism. Geert, I'm so glad to have you on. It's great to hear your voice after all this time.
Yes, it's been a while.
It's funny, reading your new book, Sad by Design, was an interesting experience for me. It puts me in a mood of almost techno-nostalgia. Mm. I remember the first time I met you was in 1993 at a conference you put on called The Next 5 Minutes at the Paradiso in Amsterdam. And it had, you know, media activists from Paul Garin, who was the young man who taped the Tompkins Square riots with his camcorder and captured police beating the protesters, to Canadian media theorist Arthur Croker, to the punk kids from Oxford, who today are respected media scholars like Matthew Fuller, to Marty Lucas from Deep Dish TV. And it felt like this magical moment that the internet had come and it would release the power of our countercultural Marxist and anarchist movements. And I wasn't a Silicon Valley techno-optimist, but a cyberpunk techno-optimist who believed that the net would break the tyranny of top-down corporations and the yuppie scum who ran them. It felt like the graffiti hacker world was upon us. But now when I read your book, Sad by Design, one concept that you helped elucidate there is that really only this first initiative, this first impulse in a new technology that has that kind of integrity to it.
Yeah, that's true. This is an old wisdom. Those who step in first have an unbiased view, a kind of panoramic overview of all the possibilities that are out there when a new medium unfolds. And those pioneers, they are gifted with that prime, very pristine view from up on the mountain where you can see the entire landscape. Maybe that's also why we admire the pioneers, because we know that they had that very pristine moment, which we can no longer have. Yeah, so I have, no any kind of critique of the pioneers, right? This was not the point at the time. I think in Europe at the time, we just came from, the important moment of the fall of the Berlin Wall. A lot of possibilities also in Europe started to become possible, Europe being, reunited. Suddenly there was a prospect again after so many years and decades of economic decline. There was a prospect of growth. So yes, there was that optimism, but we were getting ready for, the fight that we're in right now, one, two decades later, the fight with the new giants over the very terms of how we communicate, how we relate to each other, how we organize our social life in this digital age. Yeah, maybe at the time it looked like, this was about a deconstruction of utopian agendas. But that was only, for me, a minor part of the story back then.
I guess I equated the internet with a can of spray paint. I remember a lot of the kids who came to the Next 5 Minutes conference. They were themselves graffiti artists and camcorder activists.
Yeah, sure.
And it seemed that consumer technology had finally caught up with broadcast technology, and it would counter those forces of top-down mainstream media. But many of us, we really just couldn't imagine the coming monopolization of this decentralized space of home computers by giant central corporations.
Yeah.
Your earlier work, really, over the last decade or two, has chronicled the story of these economic waves, these empires.
Sure. From IBM to Microsoft to, to Google, Facebook, now a whole variety of, monopoly platform players, Uber, Airbnb, and so
right.
on. Yes, the story continues.
And then what you argue in this book, which is both saddening and heartening to me, is that, if we want to smash platform capitalism, which many of our Team Human listeners want to do, then a political economy analysis will not be sufficient. For listeners who don't know what the term political economy, it's political economy really just means looking through the lens of media ownership and economics and the power that these players then have over policy. But what you're saying, Kurt, is that this is important but not sufficient. You're really returning here to the human or to the psyche and saying that we need to engage with an almost spiritual or experiential layer of reality.
Very true. Very true, Douglas. Yes. And that's the point I'm trying to make, because our analysis may be correct and time will be on our side. But, young kids these days grow up in a very, very different political environment, which is in a strange way, deeply conservative or regressive, let's say. And it is also a time in which there are almost no traditional social movements or protests movements. Of course, we can list them. There are protests, but they don't generate really larger social contexts that become sustainable, where you can really sign up and join them. This is really difficult. You can like them, yes, but this is already a really important distinction. Liking is not joining, is not really becoming part of it. So if we want to do something with this analysis of the social media platforms and really overturn these monopolies, what we need to do is try to understand more of the psyche of the users, and in particular the young users. And this is what I've been trying to do in this book. And in my view, if we do not connect with the very real tensions, paradoxes, the deep wishes, the very confused, you know, behaviors that are all out there in the online world and are now so deeply mixed as well with the everyday experience. There is hardly any distinction, let's say, anymore to make between the real and the virtual. We all know that. So maybe one of the problems we're facing now is that they're so deeply intertwined, interconnected. And in this book, I try to do that, to tell, you know, some stories. I take some metaphors. I take some elements out of what I see. And the two of them that I go into are, the world of distraction on the one hand, and the other one is the world of sadness. You know, people find a lot of things very sad. And I started to notice this. And then I started to do some systematic work on this feeling, what this contemporary form of melancholia actually is all about.
But you seem to suggest that it's the truth itself that makes us sad. You know, and if that's the truth, in other words, and it is, I mean, the truth, if you're going to open your awareness to what's happening in our world, you have to be somewhat sad. There's a sadness that will be a part of it, whether it's the sadness of not being able to fully connect to the other people in our lives, the sadness for the refugees who are starving, or the 100 children a day Syrian refugees who are dying from cholera, or, you know, where there's enough to make us sad. The truth makes us sad, but there's almost a quality of where you're saying the internet or social media in its effort, or its corporate effort to draw us in, it's almost like these rabbit holes of sadness, saying, come in, be sad here. And you can almost get stuck there. It's almost like the Bardo experience, you know, where you're trying to get out of the body, and you could be pulled by a temptation, you know, or you could be just pulled by infinite sadness. And on a certain level, it feels like you're saying that there's a different way to engage with sadness. You know, maybe in the 60s and 70s, you put on a Joni Mitchell album like Blue, you know, sure. And experienced sadness as beauty or as compassion. I mean, it seems like part of what you're arguing, at least at the outset, is don't just follow, don't pull on the thread of sadness, because it's never going to end, particularly out on the internet.
Yeah, but I'm also saying if we just ignore it, we will not overcome it. So this is the problem. So by just walking away as an activist, let's say, and say, you know, we have to look and point at the real political contradictions, this will not, take us anywhere. And this is the problem. This is a call to arms for activists to seriously engage with the emotional psyche of so many young people who are drawn into this world, who do not exactly know how to get out of it. Because in my view, let's say the old to European resolution, the proposal, what I call offline romanticism, is not an option. And I think this is not going to... Yeah, the idea of just putting the phone away or just switching it off and then hope for the best. This is the problem. It's not working.
I wish it did, though.
Yeah,
it's like
I wish it did, right?
I remember in the 70s.
Right?
But I know, in the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of people who said, oh, we just don't have a television in our home. I don't let my children watch television. As if that would be enough to just to make them, you know, smart, engaged citizens. And it wasn't.
Yeah, but these days it's much worse, because our entire social life is out there, right? So we could say in the 70s or 80s, we were talking about sources of information, right? We were not talking about the fact that these sources of information is completely intertwined with our intimate social life that really matters to us. Yeah? And so this is also what I'm saying. Okay, we can have a good laugh about, you know, the youngsters who have 500-600 so-called friends on Facebook when they start, right? I'm not even talking about them a couple of years later and
right.
how many so-called friends or followers they have gathered that they have not even a clue about who they are. We can ironically look down on that, but that's precisely not what I'm trying to achieve here.
Right. I mean, and you do say, you know, early on that there's it feels like there's this choice between, you know, smashing the smartphone or changing the smartphone. You know, it's how do we change how it works? I guess what you're saying is we have to do the latter. We have to change.
Yeah. Or to go back to another, let's say, European thinker, Nietzsche, to say, how can we overcome the smartphone? Right. Which is another way of looking at it, an approach that a contemporary German philosopher, now very much on the right side, Peter Sloterdijk, is exactly investigating in his book "We Have to Change Our Lives" and how can we overcome the technology, which is a very different approach than just putting it aside, because if you overcome it, you will in one way or another embody it as well, right?
So what does overcoming a technology look like?
Well, first of all, I think let's just look at the first stage, how to do that. It would, for instance, mean that you can still use it in an intense way, psychologically, mentally. You try to learn how to deal with the addictive sides of it. And this is the real problem. We need to go back to it every few minutes. And if you watch, you know, young people, it is indeed compulsive. They cannot really do so much about it. They have to every few minutes look at what's going on. This is how the software is designed. We know that Facebook and all that, they use behavioral scientist tricks. They've all incorporated that in their interface design, and we are forced to go back and drawn into it again, because we need that update. We need to know what's going on. We need to know if the other is online. Did he or she respond? Right? These are vital pieces of information.
Right. And they're just being leveraged, though. I mean, they're taking, you know, true or real or even beneficial social attributes and behaviors and leveraging and magnifying them with the technology to make the platforms themselves addictive. And there's, you know, now there's, and I never know how to respond to these folks, but there's the new, you know, humane technology movement.
I followed that, yeah.
Yeah, and on the one hand, when I first heard about them, I said, oh, great, you know, and they've read my books and they care about making things less impulsive. And, you know, I met the guy at one conference, I met the guy who developed the streak feature for Snapchat, who now feels terribly guilty about, you know, taking Las Vegas, you know, slot machine algorithms and putting them into social media news feeds and wants to do good things. And they're all joining the humane technology movement. But, you know, as I've said on this show, when I hear them talking about humane technology, it sounds to me like, you know, cage-free chickens, that they're still going to extract our data. They're still going to, victimize us one way or another, but they're going to try to do it as humanely as possible. And every argument they make is like, well, you can still make a lot of money as a big platform, but you don't have to be quite as abusive to your users. That it's a compromise that still sort of rubs me the wrong way. It doesn't feel like they're in it for the humans so much as looking for a way to create a some sort of a demilitarized zone between humans and these companies.
In the past, I thought, Douglas, that there would inevitably be a counter movement underway that would look down on the smartphone as something that is ancient, that is silly, that is kind of, you know, mundane, old-fashioned, for the old farts, for something that is, you know, so not cool. And
right.
So the question is, how can we uncool this this object? And one way of doing that is, first of all, to understand all these things that are at play. Another for me is really to not walk into the trap of offline romanticism, but to target it straight on, right? So to deny things and to hope that it will somehow, someday, be gone away, become unpopular. I think we've passed that point. People are right to say that, especially young people, they are locked in. And there's no way for them on their own to just escape, to liberate themselves, which I find, you know, to be honest, a sad and saddening, a tragic thought that the rebellious energy, let's say, is not, maybe it's there, but it will not focus itself on that very, very strategic object that they carry around with them and, you know, is with them day and night in such a close and intimate way.
So because they can't, you think it's then it's up to the industry to try to, you know, modify its abuse? So, I mean, you kind of, in general, you would approve of the humane technology movement as a as an industry kind of a self-regulation.
Yes. Not coming from the industry. I think the way we need to overhaul these systems is, you know, the way we've done it in over the past decades. And that means that we thinkers, artists, activists, cultural workers, we have a special responsibility, because in the end, we are working in the, you know, in the concept factories. We are, you know, through education, through artworks, through all the labs we have and the free spaces that we still have, we can make a difference. And it's very unlikely that this difference will come from inside, let's say, Silicon Valley. I don't believe this. They are themselves highly addicted, not to their own technologies, but to the revenue streams they have set up, right? So for Google and Facebook, just to pull out of the advertisement market, the one, you know, that you have studied so intimately, and you know that I learned a lot from you in in that respect, how they set up this revenue stream that we don't know much about, and still so much of that is invisible, and we still understand so little of how these giants are making these billions of dollars, you know. So for them to unhook from that money stream is gonna be the real question. So and I don't see that for instance in Europe we will be able to do that through top-down regulation. I don't think we can regulate a bit of privacy, a bit of this and that, but that's not going to make a crucial difference.
And it's interesting the way you use the word Europe in this book almost feels like Europe represents humanism. You talk about, America is stuck with these kind of giant corporations running things, where it's some sort of top-down capitalism running or determining our engagement with technology. And you contrast that with China on the other side, which is, doing it through government repression or using these tools that way. And you sort of suggest that Europe might be able to offer this third alternative, the sort of the human alternative. And
well, yes, I do believe this. You're right, but
you don't mean Europe, the countries, even.
You know, it's not. I have trouble saying that because it comes from a position of extraordinary weakness, right? Europe is neither the hardware production place, which is China, nor has it developed its own Silicon Valley. And this is a very easy observation to make. So Europe sits somewhere in the middle. It's a medium-sized consumer market with 500 million people. And it is because of that kind of mid-size continent that it can maybe make a difference, but maybe in a little bit of time, give it a few more decades, India will probably have a similar size.
But I'm interested in Europe less as the region than Europe almost as an idea. In other words, that when you were talking about the possibility for art or content or experiences to communicate to young people and maybe change their orientation to these technologies or change the way they understand their consciousness or their experience as related to social networks and different technological designs, that feels like that to me is what Europe the idea represents. In other words, Europe the idea of an artistic tradition.
Yeah, that's true. We're deeply content people, right? And of course, in the Silicon Valley notion of things, content no longer matters.
Right.
And Europe has learned this the hard way over the past decades. So it is out of that weakness, it's out of that almost irrelevant position of, we the content continent.
Right, but there's a beauty in that, though.
Yeah, there's a beauty in it. Absolutely. I agree. But it's also, at least its starting point is a rather tragic one.
This is the other element that I keep having such trepidation about bringing in. It's back to your quote. If we want to smash platform capitalism, a political economy analysis will not be sufficient. So here, when I think of my career, I started as a theater person and came to realize that, oh my gosh, my Brechtian understanding of the world is not going to be enough. And I met people like you and Mark Derry and Richard Barbrook, the Marxists, the thinkers, the economists. And I spent 20 years getting a political economic analysis of the landscape and wrote books about, Google and Facebook and the economy and capitalism and currency. And while I was doing that work, I felt so suspicious of theater and fiction and all the people saying, oh, what we need is a new story so young people can understand a new narrative, a new way. And I almost started to use the word narrative as a way of knowing that this person is just spouting bullshit.
Sure. It's a joke.
But now It's come full circle where the people who, like you, who originally turned me, it's funny to say, you turned me on definitely. To Marx, but the people who turned me on to Marx are now coming around and saying, well, wait a minute, we need to engage with people through art, through story, through narrative. We need to make another sort of experiential worldview available to people.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case, because otherwise we'll just be stuck in this social media cage.
I guess. I mean, in some ways you're saying it's not enough to be right.
No, it's definitely not enough. And that is in a funny way going way beyond the current debate about truth and fake news and so on, right? Mm-hmm. It has something to do also with persuasion and with desire, with the feeling that you're being taken seriously, your voice counts, makes a difference, and maybe also that you're not alone. I think that's also a funny way. You know, are we really together? This is the really problematic side. This question I once posed, like, what is the social in social media? Where is it coming from? What does it mean? Do we create new social bonds in that environment? Or,
right.
And can we think of another form of social life beyond these platforms? Or I think there must be so many different ways of social life, you know? I think we really need this radical collective imagination to think up completely different social relationships from the ones we have right now.
Well, right, because as we know, the social relationships we have online, they don't trigger the mirror neurons. They don't release the same oxytocin. So we have, you know, a social engagement without the sort of the biological proof. we end up distrusting the other person because I had the engagement, but it didn't activate what it should have enacted or activated. And you don't blame the technology. You don't blame Skype for that. You blame the other human and or your own sadness, your own insufficiency.
Or anger, for that matter, right?
Right.
I haven't made a sufficient analysis of the anger part, and I'm fully aware of that in this book. Already early on, I discovered, of course, that the sadness is predominantly a female or feminine feeling, which is very interesting. And there are even sources from inside Silicon Valley who admit, you know, that the social media architectures, the way they are designed, are primarily designed for women, not by women, of course, because there's hardly a woman involved. So this is in itself quite interesting. This is all designed by males, primarily for a female market. So this is interesting. The sadness is, I interpret it, and you can see that in my sources. I mean, they're overwhelmingly female. And there is even, a feminist reading of the sadness and in relation even to technology. And we all are very aware that the counterpart of it is the anger, are the trolls, are the males that are completely out of control online,
right? Because they can do what they do in this disconnected space much more easily than they could with eye contact, although I guess they're training themselves to get to that insensitive place where they can. But there was something else you were just mentioned when you were talking about the idea of people's voice, and especially young people, wondering if they have a voice, much less can they even express what their voice is online. The difference between the voice that we would share and project online versus all of the data that's being taken from us anyway. So it's a strange conundrum where a young person is both more observed, more watched than ever before, but at the same time, their voice is more drowned out, and helping people distinguish between what is it to share everything about yourself, even the stuff about yourself that you don't yourself know about yourself, and at the same time, feeling silenced.
Yeah, but there's a multiplicity of ways to, express your emotions, but they are done within a very specific format. And look at the selfie. We know exactly how limited, in a way, the selfie is, right? It's a repertoire. You can express X, Y, Z emotions through ABC gestures. We know them all by now. But this format is not a voice, you know. So the selfie format is not exactly giving people a voice. And maybe that's, you know, that's what I'm looking for. So the format is indeed, giving young people the possibility or to express themselves. There's no doubt, right? Mm. They're making hundreds of selfies.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not the point. But is it essential? Is it really strategic, Douglas, that we propose this idea that there is a voice beyond those strict formats? Is that a way out?
I think it is. You know, I think, you know, I've often talked to young people about how the formats online became easier but more restrictive as we moved from the wild World Wide Web of HTML to, you know, to MySpace and ultimately to Facebook, you know, where it's a cookie cutter presentation that it's not a mirror of who you are. It's like Lego. You can only put it together with the pieces that they've given you. But the more you are raised in an environment where those are the only pieces you have to express who you are, the more you tend to think of yourself as composed of those pieces.
Yeah, this is it's so difficult, you know. This is kind of where I stop, because it's now up to maybe others to design those new voices. And how can a voice be designed in a way that it doesn't become a format? Let's say, let's put that
right,
first of all, out there as a challenge.
Right. Well, the other way of saying that is, how can we do any creative social act without it becoming commodified?
Yeah, no, true. And then, observed, surveilled.
Right.
I mean,
but
that.
I guess, right. But you are arguing that while many of us have looked at it through the lens of capitalism or what capitalism does. Like, okay, here's a social interaction. Now capitalism comes and ruins it. To say that, well, that's an element of it, but you're trying to almost pull back further and say it's a different, almost dehumanizing force that we're contending with.
Well, one of the problems there is, of course, that there is this layer. So there's the layer of the visible, and element can be very sensitive, and it can be very personal. But nonetheless, the moment you do that, when you're on Tinder, on whatever platform, wherever you are, right? WhatsApp, you name it. There is that other hidden element of extraction. The fact that no matter, you know, how intimate, how direct you communicate, you're producing data. Those data are recorded. They are then used against you. They are, right? And there's not even a way you can really see that. How can we, you know, raise that visibility of that invisible layer? Because I think the critique of platform capitalism, you know, is directed at that invisible layer. It's not targeted at the individuals who have the most, you know, strange and wonderful experiences with their friends or people they don't know at all.
Well, you say in early on, you say when you're trying to describe the sadness, you say that the sadness that it expresses the growing gap between the self-image of a perceived social status and the actual precarious reality, which is an interesting way of saying it. So there's this your perceived social status online and what's really going on in your life.
Well, that, we know that, this gap is growing by the day, and particularly, I think, in the United States, I'm always shocked, Douglas, when I see the statistics of what a medium income, an annual income in your country is. You know, it's so low, and it's going down, right? We know that the middle class, you know, has lost all ground, and people feel they're in a free fall. And at the same time, as they're in that free fall, they're online, and they have a very, very complex, you know, social life out there. And
well,
yes, that gap is what occupies me.
And that, well, the darkest truth or vision that you share in this book, it kind of goes all the way back to you know, IBM and the punch cards, and you know, the 2000 punch card machines that were being used, you know, by the Nazis in their concentration camps with the full knowledge of IBM, and IBM subsidiaries actually designing the applications. And I mean,
remotely,
remotely. So here's IBM actually, you know, it's funny because in America,
from the United States, you know,
right,
until 44, until deep into 1945, it is indeed an amazing story.
It is. And that, you know, and CEO Thomas Watson, for whom the current Watson technology was named, was fully aware and orchestrating this. You know, we still have Jews in America not buying Mercedes and BMWs and even Fords, but there's no problem with IBM that was actually you know, doing the work. You know, so the thing is, it's not just to say, oh, look, IBM is this icky company.
No, and but, I am but, describing that is because of that invisibility of what I in that chapter call, you know, technological violence, which is really difficult for me to deal with. I, in that chapter, I go back, you know, in my own past and the past of my parents and Holland in the war and the post-war period. But at the same time, you know, as I write this, the whole drama in Myanmar unfolds with an active participation of Facebook, who facilitates, you know, this genocide, and is completely unwilling and unaware, while being on the ground, that it is actively setting up these two groups and populations against one another.
Well, it partly makes me concerned that even if people like Kevin Kelly are wrong and technology doesn't want anything, it makes me concerned that the technologies may be biased for the abuse of humans, that whether it's the extreme disparity of wealth that the technologies create, or the dehumanized social sphere that they create, that maybe what IBM did with the punch cards, it wasn't so much that Thomas Watson was this evil CEO, but that the technology itself, the categorization, the perfect memory, the divisions definitions of people as different and in categories, that there might be a bias of computer technology towards these anti-human effect.
Yeah.
And you talk about it in toward the end of the book, the idea that technology is leading us to think of certain humans as part of a superhuman caste, who believe, as I wrote in this piece about billionaires trying to leave us behind, that the masses at this point are not even worth keeping alive. We don't need their labor because we have automation. They're just this big problem of healthcare. So maybe the computer as a means of population control and genocide is its ultimate purpose.
Correct. And there is something to be learned from the past there, right? And so that is also interesting. We can see and project this into the future, but we even have evidence from the past of our parents and grandparents, where they were confronted with this, abstract, violent infrastructure, with that machine, that they were overwhelmed by, because they weren't really prepared. The humans can read a political ideology. They can understand that. But can they read machines and infrastructures? This is really difficult. Only this week, something remarkable happened here in the Netherlands, that finally a very, very old Jewish guy, he went on and on in court, and he finally won the case against the Dutch railway company, the Nederlandse Spoorwegen, and he forced them to admit that they were complicit in transporting, these 120,000 Jews here in the Netherlands to the extermination camps. And this was amazing. This was the national headline. And this, this is an amazing thing. I know it's very late, and most people have died, but nonetheless, this for me was an amazing news fact.
Right, or just 3-4 years ago, BMW finally apologizes for the using Jewish slave labor in the production of the vehicles.
Sure, and this is important. This is really important work, because with that we kind of show that these infrastructures are not neutral or naive, that it's not just engineers who do some innocent work here in the background.
Right. Well, Steve Fuller, I think you know him. He's a kind of a transhumanist thinker, philosopher from the UK, or actually he's from the US, but he lives out there. And he and I and some other people were at IBM Watson in New York for a panel where we spoke with the people who do Watson. And we engaged them on the question of whether they bear any sort of responsibility or moral responsibility or ethical responsibility for how the technologies are deployed. Are they going to put restrictions and all? And for people who don't know, Watson is IBM's artificial intelligence project. They said, well, we don't really think about that it's up to our clients how these things are going to be deployed. And I'm like, well, how did that work out the last time, IBM and the Holocaust?
Yeah, I know. Please, read Edwin Black's book, IBM and the Holocaust. It's an amazing story. And I think it should really be republished and read widely, because This is an amazing story that is not really well known, I have to say.
Right. I mean, that's why I find it hopeful, that Google employees are willing to walk out, based on a China policy.
Yeah.
Of course, it's easier for them. Google employees, most of them are working together in this giant campus. Mm-hmm. So they have a real world social interaction in the lunchroom or at the cafeterias, or they're with each other. IBM is such a disparate network of offices. Everybody's, telecommuting, and it doesn't have that same social reality. So it's a little bit trickier for a company like that to engage on that level.
Yeah, but to politicize those companies is one. We need to, however, look also at the underlying infrastructure they are using, right? And one of the ideas there, which I think is becoming inevitable and that our generation really also has to address, which is kind of this unprecedented centralization of the so-called decentralized network that was once called Internet, the network of networks, right? And so how are we going to dismantle the cloud? And this is really one of the big challenges I think we have ahead, which goes well beyond the question of, let's say, nationalizing Google or splitting up the monopolies through antitrust regulation, whatever, right? There's an underlying issue of the architecture of the current infrastructure, which deeply troubles me.
Right, and then the question is: do we change that by engaging with the people who are making these things, or with the users who are, I mean, not even fully aware of how this stuff even works? I mean, it seems to me like the stories that work with humans are, you know, like you recount the story of Ellie Mills, the YouTuber who ended up, you know, having this kind of breakdown on YouTube. You know, she and because she was living the accelerated version or the amplified version of the YouTube life, she becomes this great kind of cautionary tale for anybody involved in this, that, oh my gosh, this is sadness by design, that this is the only direction this can go is towards some version of her breakdown. You know, I remember, do you remember Justin Hall? He was an early YouTuber. They made a movie about him before YouTube. They made a movie about him called Homepage, I think in the late 90s. He was one of the first bloggers who was sharing everything about the girls he was having sex with in college and everything. And, you know, 5 or 10 years into it, he ended up also having this kind of nervous breakdown video he made online. And it made a lot of us realize, oh, this is where this goes. It's sort of like showing people, if you start taking heroin now, this is where you end up. It feels like we just need another breakdown story every 6 months for people to realize, where the sadness at the end of this particular rainbow.
Yeah, if only we could just forget about it. And this is still my, let's say, my deep wish, you know, that one day a generation will wake up and they will no longer care about all this, right? And that would be such a liberation, would be such a, an amazing, shocking, probably it will be completely shocking to everyone. Like, how can you do that, right? How can you not care? It's almost inconceivable, but maybe because of that, all the more real, and maybe we are close to that point.
I think we may be. You know, my students at CUNY, these are middle and lower middle class, you know, working class kids. They've got the devices and they'll, you know, use an app like, you know, Tinder or something opportunistically to have physical comfort. But I don't think that they see it, their social media identities as who they are quite anymore. I think they look at it,
and
it's more instrumentalized.
A new form of ironic distance, right? Mm-hmm. Not only towards others, but also towards ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think they are nurturing a different sort of awareness. But the end state collectively rather than individually is if we are moving into a world where the elites no longer believe that the masses are worth keeping alive, I wonder,
the thesis of Harari, and that's why maybe also his books are popular, because he at least dares to ask those sorts of questions.
I mean, and when those questions are asked, it's funny. I think about, how does the listener hear that? Do they hear, oh, how is this bad for humanity as a collective organism? Or are they thinking, how do I position myself so that I survive when they wipe out the people that, how do I be one of the needed people versus one of the unneeded ones?
Or can we really, set up a system of redistribution of wealth in which, people will have that basic universal income? Or have forms of money and income streams that provide this the basic needs, and so that we can have more relaxed forms of life, because this rat race will not continue.
Right, and that's why toward the end of the book you get into the conversation about the commons, which is to for my money anyway, it seems more promising than universal basic income, at least in the way that UBI is talked about now on the west coast of the U.S. It's a welfare program to keep Uber going.
Of course, we're not living in progressive times, so. The idea production, even on that particular topic, is deeply conservative or techno-libertarian. Right. Give it a name, yes. But that says more about our time than it in fact says about that particular concept.
Right, exactly. And, people think I'm anti-universal basic income, which I'm not. I wrote this article that the original title before it was changed to something more sensationalist was, I used to be a fan of UBI, then I gave a talk at Uber. when I heard, Uber employees expressing their vision of UBI, I thought, oh, no, this isn't good at all. But a commons, and this goes back in some ways to some of the work in the Money Lab Reader and the other work you've done. Your argument for the commons is also an argument against sadness, no?
Yeah, it's very much an argument for new forms of sociality in which we can truly share experiences, resources, and share even our deepest thoughts, right? Because we can no longer even distinguish, of course, between all these things in times when everything is monetized, financialized. Even our private lives are.
And does I guess the question that I keep getting to, and I had Dana Boyd on the show, who wrote this, somewhat controversial essay arguing that media literacy and technology literacy has made us more vulnerable to the demagoguery of Trump than it has really educated us. But it seems to me that media literacy and understanding how these platforms really work and work on us is one of the only ways to orient ourselves.
I also still believe very much in that the way in which we will empower people is first to give them true insights and then provide the possibility that they can at least relax a little bit, if not walk away from it.
It's funny because when I first met you in 92 or 93, you were living a lifestyle that I didn't know existed, I guess. I went to college and I was like, I gotta earn money, I gotta get out there, and I was very concerned at the time with I want to express progressive and pro-human ideas, but I need them to also to be embraced by the market so that I have a career. And when I went to see you, you were like living up in this kind of little attic garret space. On the Dole.
It was a squat, and at that time it was just about to be legalized, and it became a social housing.
And you couldn't stay there at that point, or did you?
Yeah, I it was renovated, and then we came back. Yes, I lived there for a full 10 years in that house on the Amsterdam canal. I myself moved to Australia to do what you did. I did my degree there, and then I came back to start my Institute of Network Cultures back here in Amsterdam.
And now, what keeps you alive, and how can people support that if they want to? What keeps you doing your work? Is it, do government pay for the institute, or do you get donors?
Not
what
much,
happens?
But I think I still have a very comfortable position in comparison I'm not at a university, so I can't do the, you know, the traditional forms of, let's say, supervision of MAs or PhDs. Mm. It's a very, you know, let's say, low-level applied science, polytech research place. But I have tremendous freedoms and support here to run this small space, which I'm very, very proud of. And we've been doing this for 14 years, which, you know, in itself, in internet times, is, of course, a lifetime.
Yeah.
And so we've been able to build certain traditions, or to set up our own independent infrastructure. Again, I strongly believe, as an activist, that we need to have that. We cannot just only critique. We have to build up our own infrastructure and work from there. And this is what I've been doing. And people can support us by, you know, contacting us, working together, because I still strongly believe in the power of networks and networking, knowing, of course, that in the age of platforms, you know, the whole network and the whole philosophy of network is very, very much under pressure and is almost about to go distinct.
Right. I mean, and where should they go to networkcultures.org?
Yeah. And then they'll find you know, our publications, our programs, and we're particularly interested in working people who develop internet alternatives, who build up new forms of community and community networking. We're particularly interested, of course, in the whole question of monetization and financialization, and the question of how creative workers, artists, designers are going to make a living in the 21st century. This is an urgent question, and we try to answer that in the so-called Money Lab program. Mm.
Well, I love the arc of your career, and I'm you know, really inspired by this new book, by Sad by Design, which,
thank you,
on the one hand it seems like a departure, on the other hand it's almost a culmination. In some ways it feels a little bit to me like the same place in your career that the Team Human book,
yep,
is in my career.
Yeah,
that is sort of returning to this essential humanity. Mm. You know,
mm-hmm, we can speak really of a convergence there. Yeah, I strongly believe that.
And the other beauty, at least for me, of Sad by Design is looking, it helped me see sadness itself, not as something to keep trying to run away from. You know, I think in America, we're told that sadness is bad, mm-hmm, and that because of that, these platforms are able to leverage our sadness phobia,
yeah,
in a way that makes us victimized by them. But if we see sadness as part of the human experience, or at worst, you know, a warning about certain things, where the water's warm and where the water's cold, it really becomes a friend. It's a tool. It's a lamp in the darkness, you know, rather than this, rather than some poisonous external influence.
Of course, there are more harsh forms of it. Look at the depression and the way this is becoming really a big disease, burnout, right? At some point, sadness really takes a toll and becomes even a medical problem for many people. However, I have described sadness really as a very vague and general feeling in popular culture that is very widespread, that is very thin, right? It's not extreme. It's not extreme. It's the opposite of the extreme. Maybe it's even the opposite of anger in that sense as well, right? So,
right.
It's that fluidity of it that also makes it maybe hard to see, hard to identify, but we experience it all.
Mm. Well, thank you, Geert Lovink, for being on Team Human and everything you're doing. Thanks for joining Team Human. Our guest today was media activist and scholar, author of the new book, Sad by Design, Geert Loving. You can find out more about his work at networkedcultures.org. You can support Team Human and even get a copy of my upcoming book, Team Human, by subscribing to our show. Just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support. You can also read my columns based on the show's monologues at medium.com/@Rushkoff. We'll be back in the Basement Media Squad at the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at CUNY Queens next week with new strategies for intervention in the machine. You're on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.